I have an old friend who is fairly critical of my spiritual practice. Person has never never sat with me, but really questions how I can talk about spiritual work when I have a very comfortable life. I have, I have two homes, I have financial security, I have a wonderful family, children, grandchildren, a lot of comfort, I guess. And this person thinks that disqualifies me from the spiritual journey and addressing people who are homeless, struggling to get the next paycheck, fearful of deportation, fearful of the next moment in their life, on and on. And I understand that criticism, because a lot of people who I know, people who sit here, people who don't sit here, who are part of my life, have an enormity of struggle, both in the world and also internally. A lot of people with depression, anxiety, stress disorders, on and on. I mean, look, life is, Buddha put it pretty clearly, suffering. So, I want to say, in my own defense, but basically in defense of the human condition, that wherever you find yourself in life, karmically or through effort and struggle in your own part, it's all impermanent. It's all part of the whole. And whatever is at this moment is not what it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago or what it will be in the future. So let me say, when I met Rudy, I had no money, no particular prospects, no certainty on any level, emotional struggles, fears, doubts, the whole thing. I had real periods where I didn't know where the next check was going to come from. All sorts of human incompletion, if you will, that which is painful in life. But here's what happened. I met Rudy, and he told me, one, it's a life's journey, and two, you have to sit every day for the rest of your life. It's a big commandment, and I think a lot of people would find that to be unacceptable, way too difficult. And if they made a commitment at all, it might be for a few weeks. I'll try it out. But I really said, yes, I'm going to sit every day. So there were periods when I was sitting when I truly didn't know where the next paycheck was coming from. There were periods when I was sitting every day when I had experienced great loss, including Rudy himself. I had these experiences of starting to have stuff, career, some weekly paycheck, and then feeling it wasn't addressing the core need of my psyche and my soul, which was described to me as in my own self as spiritual, that I needed more. And, you know, I had a job. I was at one point a curator at a major museum in New York, for a film department, the Whitney Museum. And Rudy had passed, and I'm going, I'm not sure how to sustain all of what's going on. And we, as a group, those of us who survived as students of Rudy's, created what was going to be an ashram on Broadway and 13th Street in New York. And then we couldn't pull it off. The main guy who was leading the thrust of this said, I can't do it, which in the end may have been good, because I, at that point, had one son already, Joshua, and Blanche and I, and the room we were going to have in this new structure on 13th Street, in fact, was about 8 by 12 feet for the three of us. And it didn't work out. And a part of me was like grateful, and a part of me was like, now what? And the guy who ran the ashram in Indiana said to me, you should come here. If you want your spiritual life, this is where you should come. And so, with Blanche's blessing, really, we gave up every bit of security we had. We gave up a job as a curator, which is, you know, was not what I wanted to be in life, but it definitely paid the bills and was very prestigious in a funny way. And Blanche and I and Joshua moved to a room that was about 8 by 12 in an ashram. You were there, Bruce, so you know the story. And we were in this room, and it was, for a very long time, remarkably joyful. Of course, I had all these dreams that I would write scripts and people would pay me money, or I would continue doing film work in Indiana, and then discovered nobody in Indiana cared about movies, and there was no work for me to do, and I had no money at all. And I ended up working in a wine and cheese store, selling wine which I didn't drink and cheese which I didn't know one cheese from another. But I sold them to people, and I enjoyed myself in that space. And I enjoyed the people I was with. I actually loved living in a large group, an ashram with hundreds of people. It was a great embrace for me. And then it soured, and I won't go into all the souring, because it soured from the top. And we had to figure out what to do. And, you know, and I had gone back to school to get a master's degree only because I could get a student loan that would pay the bills. And Blanche got a doctorate and could actually get work, but nowhere in any city or place that we would want to go. And we ended up going to a city we didn't want to go to particularly, called DeKalb, Illinois, which is in the cornfields of Illinois, about 75 miles from Chicago. And we lived there in a really depleted space. It was flat and uninteresting on every possible level. And we started vaguely to socialize with some of the people in Blanche's department. And then once we went out to dinner with these couple that we really liked and we talked about our ashram years, they never wanted to see us again, ever. So we were really isolated, and I didn't know what to do, so I decided I would start teaching Hatha Yoga, which I knew how to teach, at the university as a kind of a, you know, a class you could sign up for as an extracurricular thing outside of the main school. And I got about 12 students, and when the class came to an end, I privately said, look, I can teach a meditation class that I'm happy to teach for nothing in my home if you would like to come. And about 6 of them came. And they became a foundation for this thing that I did every day, which was sitting. They became an expression of that. I was able to teach them what I was doing, and that nurtured me. I had no money. We were living on Blanche's salary, which was not enough. I got occasional little jobs in Chicago, which did not pay enough. And we were hungry and not starving, but we really had very, very little. And I sat every day, every single day. And every day that I sat, all of my troubles and all of my worries and all of my future, I had no career, I had no idea what anything would be. I felt like my film career was evaporating. I didn't have one, but it was evaporating as an idea. What took place was, in sitting, I would find this place that would say, basically and fundamentally, it's okay. You're okay. Don't worry. Just be. And I would do it regularly, and I would have this fundamental, foundational part of myself that said, fear not. You probably know this part of the story, but it's an interesting part of the story. I did write a movie, and it did get made. It got made with my name as story by rather than script by, which was very painful. But it got made. It got made, it's called Brainstorm. The star of the film, Natalie Wood, died in the last weeks of shooting. Everything that can go wrong with a film went wrong with it, including how long it took to even get it made. And then, of course, not hardly anybody went to see it. And here I was with what I thought, burgeoning career, and then I had no career because nobody had gone to see the movie. And in Hollywood, a movie that doesn't make money is meaningless. It has no value. And here I had finally gotten something, and now I had nothing. But something happened, and that was we had a lunch with this guy, Brian De Palma, who was an old friend of mine from college days. And Brian was a very successful movie maker. He said, Bruce, if you want a career, you got to be here. And Blanche and I flew back to DeKalb, Illinois, into the desolate, cornfields. And Blanche went to the department head and quit her job. She said, we're leaving. And she took a picture of our house, and we put it at the local supermarket with little tabs saying for sale. You could pull off the phone number. We sold our house. And we had enough money to live for 2 months. 2 months. And we moved to California to have and pursue a film career that had no rhyme or reason for happening. But it did happen. And it happened because we risked everything, literally everything, to make that trip. It was what I call a leap of faith. And forgive me, I know this is an old story, but when you find this underlying foundational courage to live your life that comes out of sitting still and meditating every day, you can take chances because you trust the universe and because you have the courage of your convictions and you have this equalizing, stabilizing thing in your life that allows you to reach out beyond anything that's known or predictable and just go yes to life. It's an exquisite way to live. It's an exquisite gift. And if you find that gift and if you embrace that gift, it offers you these extraordinary things. So you get to a place in life where suddenly you're rooted properly, life is flowing through you, you're open-hearted, you're open-minded, your gut is producing huge amounts of material in the world, and you're successful. Good things happen. Now, maybe they don't happen, but in my case, they did happen. Did that disqualify me from sitting here and teaching, from telling you there's this glorious, beautiful life to be had from a meditative practice? No. Because I went through everything you are going through, will go through, have gone through. I have lived my life the way you're living your life. That's all I can tell you. I have come to a place where I have not so much earned the right, but have experienced the ride that I can share with you. And sharing that ride is very valuable because you don't disqualify yourself from a spiritual life by being successful, by having a happy life, by having children that you love and grandchildren you adore, by having a wife who gave you and supported you through everything and who you recognize for the gift of God that she is. All of this stuff can come. It is not a disqualifier. It is, if anything, a qualifier for this exquisite thing that can take place, which is finally years and years of sitting and trusting life allow you to let go of the thing that you think brought you all of this, which is your own persona, your own self. Your ego-minded, courageous, trusting self really was, in a sense, essential to the final freedom from that self completely, to let it go, to let it fall away. One of the things I have deeply understood is that awakening and enlightenment is an act of grace from something greater than you. However, there is what I would call an ego, individualized, personalized dialogue with the infinite. That is what you are as a human being. Your body, your mind, your ego, your story, your conditions, your frustrations, your anger, all of that stuff is in a daily dialogue with the vastness and the infinite nature of being. You cannot let go of the ego until the ego has expended itself in the job of an ego is with this thing of Maslow, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. As you reach up the pyramid toward the tip of the pyramid, which is spiritual release, you go through all the levels of human life, all of the struggles that go on until you reach that pinnacle. The ego is the support for that. The ego is essential to that. Your ego drama is actually part and parcel of the building of the universe and of the world that we know. It's not a bad thing. It's not your enemy. It is not something to be taken in the alley and slit its throat, although Rudy sometimes said that was an approach. But what the ego is, in a healthy sense, is something that brings you to sit down every day and let go of it. The ego, the healthy ego, brings you to a meditative pose once a day or twice a day maybe, and for 20 minutes or 30 minutes you sit there and you let it go and you ask inside in our practice for help to surrender, and you let go of all of your stuff, all of your conniving and worrying and doubting and fearing and hoping and all of that stuff for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, you just go, quietude. That dialogue with that still pointedness, that entering into a place of loving stillness, embrace, conscious trust, you find that place in yourself, and you find it no matter whether you have work, a job, whether you're penniless, whether you're struggling, whether you are having a good day or a bad day, whether or not the bill collectors are hounding you, whatever it is, you take that period of time and you sit every day, and your ego is doing this really fundamental thing. It is practicing letting go. It is practicing surrender. It is practicing handing itself over to something greater. And you can do it under any circumstance. If anything, it's essential to do it under every circumstance. Because the reason you sit every day is because some days you're going to be in a state of joy and bliss and you go, why should I bother? Why should I sit? Because that joy is temporary, it is impermanent, and it will not be there the next day necessarily. And sitting is part of the practice. If you only sit on a bad day, you're not going to be able to handle the good days properly. If you only sit on the good days, the bad days will decimate you. So it's the regularity of sitting and finding stillness and finding that place of being, and we can even call it well-being, in yourself is such an exquisite practice that at some point the dialogue of ego that says, I don't really want to sit today. I better sit today. I got to do this. I got it. It's my discipline. It's what I do. That ego thing is actually leading you to the table and is ultimately going to hand you over to something greater, so that you discover that the ego has been part of the process. It's part of the work of freeing yourself from itself. It is an extraordinary journey, an essential journey. And if you are willing to give yourself over to that journey, something can happen, which is at some point, this thing wakes up. It just wakes up. It becomes lighter or enlightened. And you realize the ego that was carrying you on this journey has served its purpose, and it's done. It's finished. It's just like when you're a kid and you let go of being a kid. When you're moving to the next step and the next step and the next step. The thing that was learning to be something is no longer required. I have images now, videotapes that are going to be totally embarrassing to my grandchildren, of them crying and screaming and dancing and yelling and doing all of this stuff that was crucial, crucial learning process. You don't do that when you're 30. You don't do that stuff when you're 30. You've learned mechanisms that control those impulses. You find a way to live better. But you needed that learning process to be able to go into the next step and the next step. You need your ego to carry you into a place of truly, truly asking to let go. And I will tell you from my experience that the awakening to egolessness is not an end of anything. It is a new birth into something else, indescribable, beyond mostly what we talk about in the human universe, because there aren't a lot of words for it. But letting go of everything, that surrender, is like a flower going like this. The ego goes away and the self just begins this unfolding, this flowering, this opening that has, from everything I can see, no end. And it is rich beyond anything the ego can ever imagine. And the ego, rather than being decimated, is still a little tiny piece of this incredible vastness. And the dialogue between the vastness and the little tiny piece becomes so exquisitely beautiful and so love-filled and so gratitude-dominated that you walk around in a state of constant, I don't mean interrupted, because it can be interrupted, but it's constant like the air is constant. There is a sense of gratitude that pervades everything, everything. And my experience, as I've been describing post-India particularly, is that that gratitude has not let up. It's like the new air I breathe. It's just there. It's there all the time. It floods out. It floods into you, because the gratitude is absolutely tangible, rich, dynamic, and it is not Bruce's gratitude, it is the universe's gratitude for you. For you. It loves itself. It loves what it is. It loves its creation. As I say to people over and over, it took, I mean, look, this is a joke, 14 billion years to make this. Now, who, I mean, billions of years, who knows? But it took something, something to build what we're looking at right now. It took something. And why did it do it? Well, in the simplest terms, for you. Period. You as a separate individual, you as the emanation of its own nature, of its own self. It did it for itself, but you are itself. How can you not appreciate it? Yes, I know you may have days with no money, and you may have days where you're suffering, and you may have days where you almost wish you weren't here. you know? But if you have a practice and you sit still no matter what for a period of time in the middle of that suffering, what happens? The suffering alleviates, stillness pervades, gratitude arises, and you sit for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes in a state of grace, of beauty, of thank you. That's what you get. That's what's at the core of all of us. And if you aren't sitting that way and you're not doing that, you're missing out. So the fact that I've had a good life is not a discounting of my capacity to be a teacher or to be a meditator or to have the ability to have spiritual pleasure. You know, it's like, well, of course, you have money, you're successful, you're going to have all this bullshit. You know, I know so many people who have all that stuff and aren't even close to the contentment of being. It's earned by sitting every day until you arrive at a place where sitting is no longer required, because in a certain sense you are sitting all the time, all day, all night long. That's really what you arrive at. It's not like you sit for 20, 30 minutes. You are that which happens when you sit. Period. It becomes the constant. It becomes the nature of your being. And then all you want to do is share it. Say thank you to it and to everyone around you who mirrors that reality. To embrace it, to feel anything you can for another human being, which often becomes primarily compassion, because you just get that they're missing this. Because most people miss this entirely. They live a whole life without once knowing what I'm talking about, never having sat still, or having sat still found their mind to be so noisy that they ran the other way as fast as they could. Totally get that. The mind is scary. We're threatened of ourselves. That mind is always going, and you think it's you. The great revelation about sitting still is that mind is its own thing. It's not you. It's its own thing. You can identify with it. You can make it you. You have a history of making it you, but you sit still, and it's not you at all. It's just a thing. And it's very easy to make it yours, but it's really like a computer program that's just trying mostly to protect you, trying to keep you doing stuff, telling you don't do this, don't do that, and then it gets waylaid by fears and thoughts of its own, and then you're trapped in all of that. And so when you're free of that, you feel enormous love for the people who you would love to know that freedom is possible. And you can't give it to people, you can't shove it down their throats, there's nothing you can do. All you can do is be, and maybe somebody will come to you and say, how come you're so calm? What is it you know that I don't know? Maybe they'll do that. Or maybe you'll sit and teach. You know, if you have the words for it, not everybody does, but if you, like me, I'm a writer, so I articulate stuff, and I'm articulating this stuff because maybe it will break through in some way, inspire in some way, and uplift in a way, and people will start to become free or led to stillness. But here's the key thing, and I gave a talk about it a while ago. It was stop, sit, stay. Stop what you're doing, sit like a dog, stay like a dog, and don't get up. Don't run away at the minute the thoughts get crazy. Sit through it. This double breath thing that we do, this meditational practice, it's really valuable because it doesn't let you get away with just sitting looking at your own bullshit. You really have to go deeper. You really have to penetrate through it. It takes the courage of doing it. But the minute you figure it out, then you're home free. Then you just make it regular, make it a part of your daily practice, and you will find yourself having an antidote to the fact that you don't have a job tomorrow. It doesn't mean you're going to be happy not having a job. It doesn't mean you won't be afraid. It doesn't mean you won't have to possibly move to a shelter with two kids or whatever it is you've got. Those things happen. But it will give you some way to balance it out a little bit and to breathe your way through what's happening, and probably to get into this space in your own gut that is foundational and constructive, and find a way to get a job and get this or get something and build your way back out of it. Hopefully. Hopefully. One way or the other, because life can get very decimated, you will always have this place to go to. It will always be your refuge. It will always be the embrace. It will always be the still point in a world of incredible noise and discomfort. It's worth it. It's worth it. So, don't disparage your ego. Don't be at war with yourself. Don't fight thinking you're going to get somewhere that's going to free you from all of this. There's nowhere to go other than right into the heart of your own being and sit still. There's no running, guys. There's only accepting, sitting, being. That's the journey. We're all on it. And either you embrace it or you don't. If you don't, look around you, you'll see the consequences. If you do, you will also see the consequences. And they're beautiful. Any questions? Oh, such enlightened. Okay, well, thank you for coming. We will continue to sit still here and share this, whatever it is, until such time as you don't need to or want to come, which is fine.